Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program is American Spine Then and Now. I know a little about the works of Andrew Bacevich and Stephen Kinzer and hold them in the highest regard. Andrew Bacevich is an author and professor at Boston University. Stephen Kinzer is the author of The Brother, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret World War. Evan Thomas is an author and professor of journalism at Princeton University. They discuss American intelligence gathering and international surveillance policies over the last half century through the current NSA crisis. Boston Globe national security reporter Brian Bender moderates.
Stephen Kinzer is a visiting fellow at the Watson Institute at Brown University and a former award-winning foreign correspondent for the New York Times and the Boston Globe. I was mesmerized by his newest book, The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret World War, which is on sale in our bookstore, and a book signing will follow tonight's discussion. Alan Dulles, of course, was one of President-elect Kennedy's first appointments to stay on as head of the CIA, and then one of the first individuals JFK fired after the disastrous Bay of Pigs invasion. Viewed from today's vantage point, the Dulles brothers are easily vilified, but Mr. Kinzer's portrayal is informed, provocative, and filled with colorful anecdotes, if not humor. As in this choice quote from the New York Post columnist, "The outlook for world peace," he wrote after watching the two brothers take on a larger and larger role in waging our nation's foreign policy, "seems to be getting dull, duller, Dulles." The two brothers also play a role in Evan Thomas's 2012 book, Ike's Bluff, President Eisenhower's Secret Battle to Save the World, in which John Foster Dulles is described at one point as a messianic moralist. But if Dwight Eisenhower comes across in Mr. Kinzer's book as knowingly approving the covert overthrow of various democratically elected leaders in the developing world, Mr. Thomas paints a far more heroic picture of a president who was fully committed to, quote, "making the case for peace in a world perpetually driven toward war." A former editor of Newsweek magazine, Evan Thomas currently teaches at Princeton University, is the author of a number of best-selling books. In the annals of American history, up until the 1950s, one's hard-pressed to name a time when two brothers, such as Alan and John Foster Dulles, held so much power in their combined hands. That is, until you fast-forward just a couple of years to the men whose story we tell in this institution. I should note that Evan Thomas thoroughly mined our archives here for his biography on Robert Kennedy and is expert in the questions of covert foreign operations and domestic eavesdropping that were used during the Kennedy presidency. When speaking of Robert Kennedy, I often refer to him, especially in the latter years of his life, as serving as the conscience of our nation. It could also be used to describe our final panelist, Andrew Bacevich, whose life has been shaped by his experience in the Army, which makes his conscientious critique of American foreign policy, and especially of our military establishment, especially compelling. A graduate of West Point, Professor Bacevich fought in the Vietnam War and later held posts in Germany and the Persian Gulf. He retired from service with the rank of colonel and has since taught at Princeton, West Point, and now at Boston University. He, too, is the author of numerous books, including The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War. Our moderator this evening is one of the nation's premier investigative journalists, Brian Bender of the Boston Globe. I have personal experience on the other end of Mr. Bender's investigative reporting about the documents housed in this library, and as a public servant working for the National Archives, I'm duty-bound to provide access to those documents following the laws governing our collections. Mr. Bender, who joined the Globe's Washington Bureau in 2001, covers the U.S. military, global terrorism, the international arms trade, and government secrecy. I cannot think of a better moderator for today's panel who knows both the history of spying in America and is also steeped in the current debate in Washington over the NSA crisis. Earlier this month, we opened a new exhibit in our museum of some original artwork from a 1964 Superman comic featuring President Kennedy, and originally conceived to help promote his physical fitness program. It was not the first time, however, that JFK appeared in a Superman comic. A few years earlier, Superman had flown into the Oval Office and confided his true identity to JFK as Clark Kent, at which point Superman states, "Because if you can't trust the President of the United States with your secret, who can you trust?" That is, in the end, I think, what we're here to discuss this evening. How can we trust our government to both gather the information it needs to build a safer and more peaceful world while maintaining certain limits of transparency, decency, and the rule of law? We all recall Superman's motto to promote truth, justice in the American way. But recent developments call into question whether we've lost our way. And if so, how do we now alter our course so that the American way is guided by the quest for truth and the pursuit of justice? To discuss these questions and more, please join me now in welcoming to the Kennedy Library Andrew Bacevich, Brian Bender, Stephen Kinzer, and Evan Thomas.
All right, well, thank you, Tom, and thanks, everyone, for coming. I think maybe we'll start at the beginning. Evan writes in his book, Ike's Bluff, that when, in the early days of the CIA, the motto of covert operations was, and I will quote, "money no object, no holds barred, no questions asked." And maybe we can start with you, Evan, and talk about how those three descriptions drove U.S. intelligence in the early days of the Cold War, but more importantly, why?
Well, we felt we were up against a great enemy, global communism, which seemed massing to take over the world. Time magazine would run these pictures of the world, and they were always turning red, great swaths of territory. So if you were a policymaker, you had to do something about it, and your choices were limited. Conventional war didn't seem like a very promising approach against a mass army in Europe. The Soviets had a lot of troops, if nothing else, and we just fought World War II. We didn't want to do that again. Nuclear war beckoned and was scary, and both sides were starting to arm, but obviously that was a disastrous solution. So what does that leave? What it left, in part, was, well, diplomacy, yes, but diplomacy backed by something, and the something that with teeth was intelligence, and particularly covert action. So the reason why money was no object and no holds were barred was we thought we were up against this awesome and frightening foe that was intent on world domination and would stop at nothing themselves. And there was a kind of moral relativism. Since they do it, we have to do it too. So American presidents, particularly President Eisenhower, basically said to Allen Dulles, you can do what you want with, at least by modern standards, very little limitation. We can talk about how successful or unsuccessful that was, but that's the setting.
Well, Stephen, maybe you can pick up from there. Enter Allen Dulles and John Foster Dulles at the, well, first in World War II and then in the early years of the Cold War. How are they, in some ways, perfectly suited to carry forward this very broad and, as Evan said, mission with teeth behind closed doors?
Hi, I'm Steve Lerman. I'm the guy that produces, edits, narrates, and promotes great speeches and interviews. I'm the guy responsible for airing in-depth interviews, speeches, and even debates on controversial subjects such as war and peace and climate change and the economy. I hope you like listening to it as much as I like producing it. Access Sacramento broadcasts it on the internet every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., and you can find the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com, as well as at Facebook.
Coming up next, from the movie Good Night and Good Luck, Edward R. Murrow addresses the Radio Television News Directors Association and Foundation.
This might just do nobody any good. At the end of this discourse, a few people may accuse this reporter of fouling his own comfortable nest, and your organization may be accused of having given hospitality to heretical and even dangerous ideas. But the elaborate structure of networks, advertising agencies, and sponsors will not be shaken or altered. It is my desire, if not my duty, to try to talk to you journeymen with some candor about what is happening to radio and television. And if what I say is responsible, I alone am responsible for the saying of it. Our history will be what we make of it. And if there are any historians about 50 or 100 years from now, and there should be preserved the kinescopes of 1 week of all three networks, they will there find, recorded in black and white and in color, evidence of decadence, escapism, and insulation from the realities of the world in which we live. We are currently wealthy, fat, comfortable, and complacent. We have a built-in allergy to unpleasant or disturbing information. Our mass media reflect this. But unless we get up off our fat surpluses and recognize that television, in the main, is being used to distract, delude, amuse, and insulate us, then television and those who finance it, those who look at it, and those who work at it may see a totally different picture too late. I began by saying that our history will be what we make it. If we go on as we are, then history will take its revenge and retribution will not limp in catching up with us. Just once in a while, let us exalt the importance of ideas and information. Let us dream to the extent of saying that on a given Sunday night, the time normally occupied by Ed Sullivan is given over to a clinical survey on the state of American education. And a week or two later, the time normally used by Steve Allen is devoted to a thoroughgoing study of American policy in the Middle East. Would the corporate image of their respective sponsors be damaged? Would the shareholders rise up in their wrath and complain? Would anything happen other than a few million people would have received a little illumination on subjects that may well determine the future of this country and therefore the future of the corporations? To those who say people wouldn't look, they wouldn't be interested, they're too complacent, indifferent, and insulated, I can only reply, there is, in one reporter's opinion, considerable evidence against that contention. But even if they are right, what have they got to lose? Because if they are right, and this instrument is good for nothing but to entertain, amuse, and insulate, then the tube is flickering now, and we will soon see that the whole struggle is lost. This instrument can teach, it can illuminate, and yes, it can even inspire. But it can do so only to the extent that humans are determined to use it towards those ends. Otherwise, it is merely wires and lights in a box. Good night, and good luck.
And now, back to American Spine, Then and Now, with Bacevich, Kinzer, Thomas, and Bender. Kinzer.
Alan Dulles was one of the co-authors of the National Security Act that created the CIA in 1947. And this act did something that was revolutionary in the history of Western intelligence services. It had never been done before. It was always a principle of these intelligence agencies, especially the British, who were then thought to have the gold standard in intelligence gathering, that you had to have a complete separation, an absolute firewall, between the people on the one hand who gathered and analyzed intelligence and the people on the other hand who carried out covert operations. The idea was that if you put these together, there would be intense pressure on all the intelligence analysts to come up with intelligence analyses that ended with the phrase, and so we need to have covert action. The CIA was created as the first Western intelligence agency that abolished that firewall. It did the intelligence gathering, the intelligence analysis, and carried out the covert action. Therefore, it was natural for an impulsive activist like Alan Dulles to tell his men, I don't want you out there to think and ponder and analyze and reflect and report and predict. I want you out there to carry out operations. They had what was called a publish or perish mentality in the CIA. If you weren't coming up with operations, you weren't doing your job. So that created a certain dynamic inside the CIA from the very beginning that turned it into an action agency rather than a real intelligence agency. And let me make one point about how this ultimately played out. In 1953, so as soon as they came into office, John Foster Dulles as Secretary of State and Alan Dulles as Director of the CIA, the first big project they undertook was the overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh's government in Iran. As they began the planning, they informed the CIA station chief in Iran of what they were going to do, naturally, since he would play a major role in the project. Now, it was always Alan Dulles' boast that the CIA station chief in any country knew more about that country than anyone, maybe anyone in the world, even more than the U.S. ambassador, because he knew what was going on under the scene, under the surface, as well as what was public. But the CIA station chief in Iran sent back a note saying, this is a crazy idea. We should not be overthrowing Mossadegh. It's only going to wind up bad for us in the end. Alan Dulles immediately sent him back a note, thank you very much, you're fired. He was pulled out of Iran, and he was replaced with a guy who had never been in Iran, but was willing to do whatever he was told. A year later, the exact same thing happened in Guatemala. The Dulles brothers decided they needed to overthrow the government of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala. They told the station chief, and the station chief told them, this is going to wind up terribly for Guatemala and terribly for us. Answer, you're fired. So this was an agency founded with what Evan properly describes as a very important motive and with a very important purpose. But because of the way it was formed and because of the self-assurance of the Dulles brothers, it turned into something different. The Dulles brothers never consulted anybody outside the two of them. Just a wink and a nod between the two of them substituted for an entire political process. So they converted the foreign policymaking process into a kind of reverberating echo chamber for their own shared certainties. They therefore undermined the concept of having wise people all over the world to tell them what was really happening and acting on the basis of what those people said.
Bacevich.
I think there's one more factor, though, that has to be understood to appreciate how all this thing kind of gets spun up at the beginning. And that's what at least I would understand to be the way that senior U.S. officials perceived the nature of the competition between the United States and the Soviet Union in what we end up calling the Cold War. And what they perceived is that the Cold War was going to be a dirty war. And one of the reasons they thought it was going to be a dirty war is what they already knew about the behavior of the Soviet Union vis-a-vis the United States before World War II, where U.S. agencies such as the FBI had acquired a great deal of information about espionage and subversive activity sponsored by the Soviet Union, using entities such as the Communist Party of USA as instruments to achieve this. During the course of World War II, I think is when they're getting the Venona intercepts, which are finally decrypted in the wake of World War II, which provide U.S. officials with an appreciation of the expansiveness of this Soviet effort before World War II to undermine the United States. So it's going to be a dirty game, hence the willingness to sort of suspend the rules and play dirty. Of course, the irony of all that is by the time you get to the post-World War II period, most of this Soviet apparatus had been identified and had been destroyed. So that when we get to people like Joseph McCarthy making his accusations about the U.S. government being totally overrun by communists and communist sympathizers, the controversy surrounding Alger, Hiss, and the like, most of that is information that may once have been to some degree true, but by the time you get to the early days of the Cold War, it's no longer true. Nonetheless, these memories from an earlier period to some degree justify and then drive the creation of this apparatus that is used for both espionage and covert operations.
Well, let me ask you then about the question of oversight. It's striking to me, reading both Stephen and Evan's books, how virtually there was no oversight. Congress did virtually none. The CIA sort of operated almost entirely independently. There were, at the time, were not even other significant members of the so-called intelligence community that might be a balance, particularly in the analytical side of things, about Soviet strength. Talk a little bit, if you can, about, number one, why there was so little oversight, to the point where, if I recall, you know, a congressional hearing where a chairman tells Alan Dulles, well, you know, don't worry about telling us that. We take your word for it. So why was it so lax? And then maybe we can start kind of moving into the future a little bit when that oversight starts to change.
Thomas.
Well, Eisenhower had a specific worry that congressional oversight would unleash the McCarthyites on the agency. McCarthy had started noodling around and looking into the agency, looking for communists there. And Dulles, to his credit, Alan Dulles stood up to him and said, go away. Not many people stood up to Joe McCarthy in 1951, 52, 53, but Alan Dulles did. And Eisenhower was fearful that congressional committees would become red hunting, witch hunting operations. So he wanted to keep Congress away. He thought he could have some oversight basically by using his friends. He had this informal, which now has become the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, but had a different name in an earlier era. But mostly those were his pals, senior military guys and Wall Street figures, Robert Lowell and diplomats, Bruce. And he sort of hoped that his buddies would look over the shoulder of the CIA and warn them if anything was going wrong. And actually, they did. They wrote a famous report in 1956 saying, all these young men are running around as kingmakers all over the world, and they're kind of out of control. And that Alan Dulles was too aggressive, and in any case, not really controlling this. And Eisenhower, who was often a strong man, was weak in this. And he said, or he rationalized it. He said about Alan Dulles, warned that Alan Dulles was allowing messes and, to take place, said it takes a strange kind of genius to run an intelligence service. And Dulles had that kind of genius. Dulles had been a spy in World War II. He sort of understood the game. Not so easy to find people like that. And Eisenhower should have fired Alan Dulles, but he didn't. To his regret, for reasons that we can later, as it turned out that John F. Kennedy had to do the firing a little bit.
I mean,
Everybody knew that it could happen. The likelihood was clear. The future was coming. Now it's here. They had to fix the levees, otherwise they'd break. On one side was the city, above it was the lake. It was in the daily papers, in bold letters was the writ. What would happen when the big one hit? But every year they cut the funding, just a little more, so they could give it to the army to fight their oil war. National Geographic and the Times-Picayune, they forecast the apocalypse, said it was coming soon. Preparations must be made, they said, now is the time. It was years ago, they shouted, inaction was a crime. They said the dikes must be improved and the wetlands must be saved. But Washington decided instead they should be paved, because malls were more important than people's lives. So put some gold dust in your eyes and hope no storm arrives. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. Years and years of warning, no evacuation plan. It was just that the waters rose. Get out if you can. There were no buses, no one chartered any trains. There was no plan to rescue all of those who would remain. All the people with no money, all the people with no wheels, all of those who couldn't hotwire one that they could steal. Thousands and thousands of people abandoned by the state, abandoned by their country, just left to meet their fate. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. Drowned inside their attics, an army of the poor, an army of the destitute who couldn't get away. And the world will remember those sad and awful days when people shouted from their houses, dying on their roofs. When people came to find them, they were turned back by the troops. They died there with no water, they died there in the heat. They were shot down by the soldiers for trying to find some food to eat. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. The city is in ruins, a massive toxic sea scattered through the nation. Half a million refugees, here we are, in the richest country on the earth, where the color of your skin determines what your life is worth. Where oil is the king, where global warming is ignored, where the very end of life is a place we're heading towards. Where it's more than just a metaphor, the flooding of the dike. And if we don't stop this madness, the whole world will be like New Orleans. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans.
And now for something completely different.